Hi everyone, just a quick content warning for this week. We are talking about Greek mythology quite extensively today, and as such, there are discussions which include mentions of sexual assault, incest, and in some cases, what could be termed family violence. If those things disturb or upset you, I would perhaps recommend sitting this one out. If not, we hope you enjoy the episode.
This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers. And swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
I created them, and they reward my love with defiance. There will be no truce. This is the end.
This is just the start.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the Rash of the Titans, or as they're usually known, the doubleheader, Clash of the Titans and Wrath of the Titans. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about these quote-unquote movies, our thoughts on them, and then get stuck into the science that they bring up, including Turning a Man to Stone and One-Eyed Monsters, how humans might survive in a world of such monsters, and then Libby will talk about separating reality from myth in Greek mythology. As always, the show will be broken up into those different segments. I will have time codes below, so you can skip ahead to whatever you want to listen to today. Before we get stuck in, my name is Sam Perrin. I am an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsick, a parasite slash disease ecologist at the Gurion Negev University of the Bin. Alongside Adam is
the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup.
It's not an accent today, it's just Australian you, yeah. In the whole movie.
Sounds like Wrath of the Titans.
It's you with a head cold.
Yeah, intense and gravelly. And last but not least, we are joined by Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist. I have not news, but just a wonderful story that I've come across this week, which is the story of Andy the Goose. Have any of you heard of Andy the Goose?
He's my best friend.
No.
This sounds vaguely familiar, but I might be thinking of Untitled Goose.
Yeah, I think that's probably what you're thinking of, yeah. I don't think Andy was the type of goose to pull this shit. So, there was a man named Gene Fleming who was living in Nebraska, which is presumably somewhere in the US, because they haven't said the country name. And when you don't say a country name, I assume it's just an American who thinks everyone in the world knows where fucking Nebraska is. Nebraska is in the States, right?
Yes. Nebraska is right next to the state that I grew up in, and there's nothing in Nebraska but cornfields.
Okay, well, there was Andy the Goose. So, Gene Fleming was an older gentleman who found this goose, which didn't have feet, had been born without proper webbed feet. And he noticed it kind of struggling along with the rest of the geese, crossing a road. So, he adopted it, took it home, and tried to make it shoes. So, he put it on a skateboard initially to see if that would help out, but the goose didn't use the skateboard. So, what he eventually went with were sneakers. So, Andy the Goose was walking around with sneakers on his feet with, like, kind of rubber stuffed into them for quite a long time and became something of a national icon. He was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Of course.
And then, murder mystery, he was killed in 1991. And they never found out who did it.
Probably the local farmer, you know, what, couple counties over who had the headless chicken and was losing all their business.
See, I think Andy was about to come out with his own line of footwear, so Nike took some appropriate action.
Nike sponsored him.
That's what they want you to think.
It's the perfect cover.
Yeah. He is the first goose ever and probably the last goose ever to have a shoe deal.
Yeah, my guess is only Goose.
Yeah.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah. But they actually made the tabloids when Andy was killed. And Weekly World News had the headline, Sicko Commits Foul Deed, with foul spelled F-O-W.
They didn't want to say murder afoot.
That's news for the week. They also found a cheetah in a cave in America, which apparently a monumental discovery, but I found a story about a goose.
Yeah, well, so. I saw a cheetah in the zoo, so what?
You were one of the geese involved in the accident Thursday. Can you tell us what happened?
And it was just mayhem. I mean, one minute we were in a perfect formation, and the next it was a complete cluster flock.
So we did a double feature, and in both Clash of the Titans and Wrath of the Titans, Perseus, an Australian demigod who just wants to have a father-son bonding fishing time, finds himself going up against monsters and a pre-balding era Voldemort to fight for his mortal family and his rapist deity daddy Zeus. These movies are based on the Greek myths in the same way that Scooby-Doo is based off Sherlock Holmes. It is a mythos smoothie that blends characters and creatures into a storyline of chaos. Perseus defeats evil, pointless female characters stand by for sexual tension, and lots of actors just collect a paycheck for this one.
Yeah.
Totally fair. Yep. Yeah. I thought this had some fun monsters at times, even though it didn't always look very good. I liked that they just went with their normal accents. Rosamund Pike was British, Sam Worthington was Australian, Gemma Arterton was British. They didn't put on any weird Chris Hemsworth, Thor, Shakespearean accents or anything like that. And they're fast. These movies both clock in at under an hour and a half.
Do they?
Yeah. The Wrath of the Titans is 85 minutes.
Felt longer.
Yeah, they felt longer. Yeah.
I liked the two brothers. In Clash of the Titans, the ridiculous, like, hunter brothers who just show up as the army's leaving, and they're like, it is good luck! We've decided we're gonna come with you. And then I do love the part that they, like, kick out, where it's like, alright, we're gonna go down to Hades and fight. They're like, we can't fight dead. Like, best of luck.
Yeah.
And which it turns out to be the best decision. Yeah. Spoiler alert.
My favorite part of the, he did it in the second movie as well. But it just really made the first movie that much more enjoyable to watch is actually Adam saying cunt in an Australian accent after Perseus's dialogue lines. And that just made the movie fantastic. So, especially when, you know, he's like talking about you four, the greatest cunts I've ever known. Yeah. And then I'll say for the actual movie, I will say Jason Fleming as Calibos was my favorite part. I think he's awesome, and I wanted to see more of him and less of everybody else.
Him fucking, what's his face, coming in with the, Mads Mikkelsen coming with a fucking flying double kick, and him just like standing right there and taking it, and the other guy bouncing off of him, no problem. He's like, fucking what? I just ripped a dude in half with my bare hands. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
These movies are obviously not great. They've got a lot of really big name actors in them somehow, and they are a ton of fun. I know they're not good movies, but I really, really enjoyed the ride these movies take you on. And I also feel like, especially Clash of the Titans, is a lot better in some ways than it has any right to be. Like, I think that in a lot of ways they do a lot of subtle things that maybe they weren't intentional or I'm reading into too much, but the beginning of the movie, Ray finds just like a sniveling little crouched, you know, Hades, and looks very small compared to all the other strong gods. But then as the movie goes on, he's like standing up more. He's like, he looks more filled out and stronger. And then at the end, he's like at the same size as Zeus. So I thought that was a really cool, subtle thing going throughout the movie.
Yeah.
And then fucking Charon's boat is full of coins. That was dope. I thought it was really neat to have that. He has to put them all somewhere, and they're just in the fucking hold of his weird inverted boat.
I will say, I would love to have seen the clearly missing movie between Clash and Wrath of Titans, where little meek Ralph Fiennes Hades goes and finds himself the equivalent of the king's speech, and then slowly builds himself up, becomes more confident, because we start Wrath of the Titans with a completely different Hades. He is like, his hairline is drastically improved, he's standing way taller, he speaks way better.
Yep.
He has gotten a fantastic Queer Eye for the Straight Guy makeover. That has just, I would watch that film.
To transition to stuff we didn't like. Look, I'll admit, I feel the same way as Adam, especially with Clash of the Titans. These are bad, and I know they're bad. They're such trash. But I really enjoyed Clash of the Titans. We got through it, and my wife said that wasn't that bad. And then I was like, okay, should we watch the second one? She was just like, God, no.
We had a similar experience with our friend who we invited over to watch the movie with us. We're like, oh, there's a second one. You ready? She said, no.
Yeah. No, I'm running. Yeah. But there's tons of shit wrong with these films. But one thing I will pick on is that there's a really varying sense of scale here. Like, when he's going up against the two big monsters, the Kraken and then Kronos in the second film. There's no real understanding of where he is in relation to them or how big they actually are. It seems to shift from, like, shot to shot. He will be, like, under its arm, and then all of a sudden it'll pan back and he's, like, 50 miles away from the thing still. It's very odd. And I loved how in the second film they tried to give Sam Worthington the typical, like, you know, the flowing Greek locks that you expect from Greek mythology. And he just looks like the most fucking rat shit, tinny drinking bogan you've ever seen in your life.
He really does.
Just Dazza down at the pub and heading home to a wife that he hates in his underground meth lab on the weekends. Fucking.
I loved it. It looks so much better than his fucking buzz cut in the first movie.
Oh, the buzz cut looked bad, but I thought the second one was just like, you shouldn't have done this. Just stay with the buzz cut if this is what this is going to
be. He looked very bogan.
Yeah.
I fucking hated Perseus being such a, and I've coined this phrase and I'm going to use it a lot, a pussiest through pretty much all of the films, but primarily the first one, that every time they're just like, hey, you want to use this sword so we don't all fucking die? And he's like, nah. And they're like, okay, like, do you want to use the flying fucking horse to get somewhere so we can get there faster so we don't have to ride scorpions? And he's like, nah. And it's only until everybody else dies that he's like, oh yeah, actually no, I'm gonna start like using this shit.
I told Adam I felt like Perseus was the god, or the demigod rather, of just getting the shit kicked out of him. Like,
yeah,
he doesn't really do anything, just takes a fucking beating.
Left, right, and center.
I should also point out one extra thing I didn't like about this is that Nicholas Holt is in the Clash of the Titans for an hour and he does not say huzzah once.
fair critique.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kept looking at him and waiting for him to turn to Perseus and be like, use the sword, you cheeky fuck.
My God, Perseus, have your balls dropped off?
It's funny, I think, so as far as my dislikes, Sam, your like was my dislike. Nothing throws me more than mixed accents. So especially, oh my God. So you have like people that are supposed to be related. One's got an Irish accent. One's got a Venezuelan accent. One's got a Bogan accent. Like, it's just too much for me when everyone's got very thick, you know, prominent accents. And of course, like, they're all supposed to be family. It makes sense if you're, like, doing it, you know, regionally, or, like, I dislike that so much.
American cultural hegemony gets a slight nudge and Libby loses her shit. I see how it goes. Okay.
I would not.
I do hate it in, what's that movie that I love? With the dragons.
How to Train Your Dragons?
How to Train Your Dragon. That pisses me off because you have an entire adult population with Scottish accents.
Absolutely.
And then the kids all sound like Seth Rogen's mates. Yep. Yeah.
I would not change Toby Kebbell's accent, though, for anything in the world. And that line that he delivers at the end where the kid comes over to him and he's like, I've read that you are a great disappointment. And he goes, yes, I am great.
Yeah.
So good. I think for me, it's a mix of inconsistent character, like, behaviors or traits. You have Perseus, who's his whole sticking point, especially in Clash of Titans, is I'm just going to use my human side to do this. It's like, bruh, you wouldn't have survived any of the shit that's been happening to you if you weren't half god. The only reason you're surviving
you're a fisherman.
The only reason you're surviving Ares running your face through column after column after column and slamming you against the wall is because you're half god. Like, you have to accept that this is part of who you are. Get the fuck over it and just move on with your life. It's fine. And then all of a sudden him liking Zeus in Wrath of the Titans, who he despised the whole first movie, who's a rapist and is also a good father now, apparently. What the fuck?
He likes
Zeus
him at the end
shit
of
about anything.
He likes him at the end of the first movie too. He's like, nah, dad.
Yeah, dad. Bringing a woman for me. How nice.
Yeah, I really thought they were going to go all in, because I didn't remember these films before I watched them at all. And you get halfway through the first film, and I really felt like they were going all in on how petty and just bickering little assholes the Greek gods were. But then they really ease off that in the second film.
Yeah.
they actually had a fairly accurate representation of Zeus, I felt like, at the beginning of, it's like, yeah. Oh, you're going to defy me? I'm going to pretend to be you, fuck your wife, and then peace out into the sunset. Also, I hate yeah. them because they don't like me enough. But then he just likes them all of a sudden.
And they tell the story of Medusa and, like, how Aphrodite was such an asshole.
Athena.
Yeah and how shitty Athena was. Yeah, and then what does Sam Worthington say? Let's go cut this bitch's head off. I'm like, you just heard her story, man. Like, why are you being such an asshole?
Leave her alone.
Yeah.
She is clearly the victim here.
She would have joined you. They're like, she's too difficult to control. If you're like, hey, do you want to come along and fuck the gods up? She'd be jumping on the scorpion ready to rock and roll.
Yeah.
Just don't look at her.
Yep, ask her nicely to put a headscarf on or something. Is it the snakes, by the way?
It's supposed to be her gaze.
Oh, okay, well then, I don't know, strong pair of sunglasses?
Blindfold. Yeah. Anything.
Yeah, but blindfold, then she can't see. That's why I said headscarf, because she, you know, still has her face.
But it's the eyeballs.
But then, if it's the eyes, then yes, a nice pair of sunnies.
I mean, she's already rocking that badass snake bra. Why does Snake Woman have tits? It makes no sense.
Because a man designed her.
You must put on the breastplate of Smargon.
I refuse to wear that. How is that supposed to protect me?
It's magically enchanted.
I love the idea that Emma Thompson almost made an accidental uncredited cameo in the movie. The first movie she showed up to visit Liam Neeson. And while they'd been filming, apparently she was, like, caught in the back of a scene.
It's even better because she was in costume for Nanny McPhee.
Oh.
She was, like, visiting him from the set of Nanny McPhee. So she hid behind his throne as Nanny McPhee.
The Nanny McPhee Wrath of the Titans shared universe.
Perfect.
And then I enjoy that Sam Worthington's sandals were Nike trainers with the toes painted on them. He didn't wear sandals because he needed his shoes to perform stunts well. I still would have preferred a goose wearing Nike shoes to perform his stunts, but that's my interpretation.
He probably would have done better than Sam Worthington.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Andy was up for the role before he was murdered in 1991.
Ah, shit.
So.
Yeah.
So,
they could have used him in the original in the 80s.
The Stygian witches were actually played by men.
What?
Yep.
Old school Shakespearean style.
Yep. Why get women to play women when you can get men? And then even though it's called The Clash of the Titans, there's actually no Titans in the first film.
Fuck.
It's a mind bender for you.
Yeah, and they don't like clash in the second film either. It's just Kronos rises up and I guess he has some wrath.
He's wrathful, like, I guess.
Yeah.
But he's one Titan.
Yeah,
no
it
titans.
Should be the Wrath of the Titan.
Yeah.
It's a nice little like bit of trivia as far as having a nice little you might have missed the appearance, but both Davos Seaworth, Liam Cunningham, and the Hound, Rory McCann are in Clash of the Titans.
Yeah, Rory McCann's in it for like 20 seconds and then he's just brutally murdered.
There's a few
he's
more
just fucking ganked.
There's a few more Game of Thrones actors in the first one as well.
Drughead weed boy from Attack the Block being the crazy fanatic in Clash of the
Is it him or is it his brother? Because he's got a brother that looks almost exactly the same as
Luke.
Yeah.
I don't know then. I would think it was him because he sounds just like
Luke
him.
Evans is in it for like 30 seconds.
Luke Evans.
Yeah.
I told Adam I thought Luke Evans should have played Ares.
Or just have Apollo be the bad guy.
Alexander Siddig is Hermes.
Oh, right.
Danny Houston is Poseidon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For like both of them for 30 seconds, they just pop in and out.
Mads Mikkelsen's in this fucking movie? What the fuck?
Oh, wonderful scene. I just love seeing Mads Mikkelsen in anything. Pete Postlethwaite as well. Perseus' dad in the first one. Disappears after like a couple of minutes on screen.
Liam Cunningham, Rory McCann, Jamie Sives, Ian White, and Alexander Siddig all appeared in Game of Thrones. Liam is Ser Davos, Rory is Sandor. Clegane Ian is Gregor, Sivas is Jory Castle, and Alexander is Doran Martell. Doran Martell.
Oh, cool.
Huh.
So the Hound and the Mountain are in this.
One of the Mountains.
And as we've already said, about the boy, Nicholas Hoult. Tony from Skins himself makes an appearance and gets killed fairly quickly. Also, Evie from Skins, or Evie? His sister in Skins, Caius Galadriel. She's also in here for 20 seconds.
Jesus.
There is a very brief shot of a small mechanical owl in the first movie. And then you see Hephaestus, played by Bill Nighy, in the second film having a conversation with a mechanical owl. And that is actually a prop from the original Clash of the Titans film from the 80s. Yeah, Archimedes imparts wisdom on Perseus throughout the 1980s film, I think.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, so my question for you, I already posed this to Libby, for you, Sam and Dave. At the end of the movie, we have
the first movie.
Perseus. At the end of Clash of the Titans, we have Zeus ride off into the sunset, and he disappears. But then all of a sudden, Io, his apparent love of his life, is here. Now, this poses two possibilities, and the second is the one that I think I agree with. One, Zeus has power over life and death, which is supposed to be Hades' domain, I have thought. Or two, Zeus just made a woman and said, like, look, it's Io. Here you go.
But it's not her.
Which is what I think he did.
Yeah, what's the question, though?
Which one do you think it was? Do you think that Zeus has power over life and death, or do you think he just made a woman that looked like Io?
There are multiple interpretations in Greek mythology where Zeus can basically call on Hades, his bitch brother, and make him bring people back.
I think that he probably just shuffled away the body before she had died and was like, oh, I'll keep her on ice for a little bit.
Ew.
And then, you know, get myself an easy win with Perseus later on by bringing her back.
I posed a third reality, which is Zeus, who is known to transform himself, actually transformed himself into Io to fuck his son, which is totally in line with Greek mythology.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Well, in
real Oedipus complex going on.
In the original Greek mythology, the way that Zeus is able to get at Perseus's mom is by forming himself into a shower of gold and striking her, at which point he is able to inseminate her loins in the translation. But he literally golden showers a woman.
How did you tell him that there was a, and I want to put this delicately, pee-pee tape?
Before we get stuck into the monsters, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at BigDrFishboy. Adam is at HarsickAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read a veritable cornucopia of short stories. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam, myself, and a huge team of international writers churn out on a weekly basis, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com.
So, obviously, we run a little bit low on some of the ecology for a lot of these organisms. We're not getting a large amount of background, and some of them are just literally large versions of whatever their counterpoint is. Like, the giant scorpions are just straight up giant scorpions.
Well, yeah. I have to say, though, that's actually just an accurate representation, because here in Israel, we do have those scorpions. We just don't see them very often because they're, like, really deep in the Negev. And it was really good that they had Ashraf Barhom play one of the hunters, because he is from Israel originally. So he's experienced with, you know, fighting for his life against these giant scorpions. Yeah.
And riding them as well. So they use it as public transpo.
I'm just picturing Adam out in the garden with a rake screaming like, stay out of the garden! Stay out of my garden!
So the ibex last week were the problem. God damn it.
So in terms of subjects that I wanted to focus on today, I picked some sort of random stuff to have a little bit of fun with.
I felt like that's what the movie did with the plot.
Fucking got him.
The first one that I wanted to talk about, because arguably they were the coolest creatures in the film, even though they do not present at any point during Greek mythology, were the djinn, right? Showing up with their artificial hearts and their sort of green eyes, their hatred of the gods. And they have a throwaway line that every time that the djinn encounter damage to themselves, they replace it with some sort of artificial piece of tissue, which is what has led them.
Isn't a specific kind of tree?
Yeah. And we see this with the djinn at one point when the Medusa stares at him and she's trying to, like, make him turn to stone. And he's just like, won't fucking work on me. So really cool. I hadn't realized the djinn are speaking Arabic throughout the entire film.
Are they? Okay.
I mean, they do come from Arabic culture. So at least they're speaking from the culture that they were originated from.
I will say, though, this is one of those moments where the film is better than it has any right to be, where Perseus is saying, you know, he does his little speech before the final showdown with Medusa of like, you know, it takes like, you know, us like men or women or whatever you are. Like it's like, it's obviously a throwaway joke for the djinn, but it's kind of nice. He didn't assume the djinn's gender. It's just like, you're whatever you are.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah.
I like that.
Now let's cut this bitch's head off.
Yeah.
No one likes a rape victim.
So I wanted to focus my first discussion on the idea of prosthetics and prosthesis to begin with. So the term prosthesis actually comes from ancient Greek to mean addition, application, or attachment. Hmm. Just out of curiosity, do you guys know what the oldest prosthetic was?
A goose's foot.
In the early 90s. It's like a fake thumb.
I would say an eyeball.
Artificial thumb, I should say.
I feel like the leg would make the most sense for it to be like a wooden leg.
So Libby is completely correct, and I would not have guessed this. The earliest recorded mention of an eye prosthetic is from the Egyptian story of the Eye of Horus, which involves the left eye of Horus being plucked out and then restored by Thoth. However, the earliest archaeological evidence of prosthetics is found in ancient Iran and dates back to somewhere between 3000 to 2800 BC, in which an eye prosthetic was found buried with a woman. The one that gets cited all the time is the artificial toe. So there is a artificial foot prosthetic, a wooden toe that was found that dates back to approximately 1000 BC in Egypt. And they believe that the was potentially made with the use of something called bitumen paste. And I don't know if you guys know what bitumen paste is.
Bitumen?
It's not bitumen, is it? Like B-I-T-U-M-E-N.
Yeah, it is. Bitumen paste.
Oh, it is bitumen. Okay.
All right. So do you guys know what bitumen paste is?
Vaguely.
So it is basically it starts its life as a early form of petroleum. So 83% carbon, 10% hydrogen. It was an essential sort of lightweight polymer that was used by a number of different cultures because it's naturally occurring. And in ancient times, they would actually use it as a sealant, adhesive, building mortar, decorative pigment, because it had a texture that was kind of similar to that of human skin. Yeah, they would mix.
And they wanted to decorate with that?
Apparently. They would heat it until the gas is condensed, and then they would add in tempering materials to tweak the recipe to get the consistency they would look with or they would look for. So adding minerals such as okra would make it thicker. Grasses and vegetable matter would add stability. Waxy oil elements such as pine resin would make it more viscous. But I love the idea that they combined all these different things and stuck it together as an artificial toe. And out here, I'm thinking, why wouldn't you just carve a piece of wood and stick it on, man? But like, yeah, you you do you. Other notable examples, Pliny the Elder.
Pliny, I thought.
Recorded the tale of Roman general Marcus Sergius, whose right hand was cut off while campaigning, and he had an iron hand made so that he could hold his shield in battle, which is subjectively badass. Yeah. That you get your hand cut off and your first response is, I can't hold a shield anymore. Stick a piece of metal on my arm so that I can go right back out to do this shit.
Why not just attach a prosthetic shield?
Or a spear.
You're a general! Yeah. Just hang out at the back!
We see what Dave's version of leadership is now.
Now,
I'm wondering if it's even more badass for maybe this general was right-handed like most people are. He got the hand cut off. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. Put a shield on there. I'll learn to fight with my left.
The biggest advancements didn't actually happen with prosthetic limbs until the early 16th century with a French doctor, Ambroise Paré, who made significant advancements in both amputation and surgery. He was the first to introduce a hinged prosthetic hand and was the first to create a leg with a locking knee joint. But some of the biggest advancements, because again, nothing took place until the carnage of the Civil War. So Americans fighting Americans allowed some really cool prosthetics to start developing as the American military complex.
Because there was a lot of limb loss.
So James Hanger was a Confederate soldier and he became the first amputee in the war and went on to invent the hanger limb, a prosthetic limb made from barrel staves and metal that featured hinged joints at the ankle and the knee. So the Hanger was the most advanced limb in the history of prosthetics at the point, and the company that he formed, Hanger, is still one of the biggest producers of prosthetic limbs today. Mm-hmm. Now, modern day limbs, we've gotten, and we've talked briefly about them before, that the newest advancements in technology are using limbs that can pick up on latent signaling associated with muscles, where a human, basically the ghost limb or the phantom limb sensations that are left behind, can be used and reprogrammed to allow for hands that can accomplish incredibly delicate procedures. Some of the newest limbs released in 2019 and tested out on veterans allow them to do things like juggle or gently pick up eggs to crack them to make eggs in the morning, which is super cool. As well as some of the newest limbs actually have the ability to give signals back to a human to give sensation that's coming from the limb. Now, as cool as all of these are, getting artificial limbs to humans in the modern day is a fucking pain in the ass. So I had not realized this until I was talking to a friend of mine whose father is a medical doctor, is diabetic, and had both of his legs amputated. He does not have artificial legs. And I was talking to her and I was like, why not? She's like, the Canadian government doesn't cover them. And yeah, straight up, we have universal healthcare, but we do not fund artificial limb replacement. In the United States, the best healthcare plans only cover 50% of an artificial limb. And artificial limb costs range between, on average, $15,000 to $90,000 for some of the most basic implants. We are not talking about these robotic ones with the new connections. Some of those limbs that they've tested out on volunteer veterans, which must feel the worst because they give you a limb, they let you play with it for a while, and they're like, and we'll take that back. They can range into the millions of dollars to build these.
Have you all, in happier news, have you all seen that video of Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark coming to the children's hospital and giving the kid the artificial arm that's like colored like Iron Man? And like he comes to him as Tony Stark and has like the Stark Industries suitcase and like hands it to him. It was really cool.
All I can imagine him saying is, "Yeah, well, people lose limbs all the time. They need to be a wine. Give me a sandwich.
make me a drink."
Yeah.
So relating all of this to the film, either our Jin are in a situation where they're literally just masking up injured body parts. They're sticking tree bark over top of it to cover it. And we've seen some of these really bad artificial prosthetics. The Boardwalk Empire has an example of some of the replacement faces that they used to use for people who'd had faces damaged during the war. They're absolutely terrifying. They got painted on.
I was about to bring that up.
That or our Jin are just way more technologically advanced than we think they are. They've just got into artificial heart making, artificial joint making, and they're just straight up adjusting everything. And they've decided the rest of the world can fuck off because they're just going to hide from the gods.
And that would be my guess.
I like that one. I think... Yeah, because Jin are magical by nature, so I feel like what magic is just technology we don't understand.
I think that, to your point, Dave, about the facial, the mask, I was going to bring that up with, I learned about it a little while ago of Anna Coleman Ladd, who used to make ceramic faces and like paint them for the soldiers who came back from World War I with their faces just completely disfigured by the horrendous things they went through. And so the Jin apparently had face masks as well.
And... I mean, I do think that the gods in this are very likely to just be a sufficiently advanced technology that showed up to Earth. Zeus, Hades, Poseidon. I mean, the way that they've created man, they've done all this, kind of feels in line. And maybe the Jinn are just a competing faction.
The ever impressive.
The one contained.
Often imitated.
But never duplicated. Genie of the lamp.
So I just wanted to ask you a question, Dave, because we've talked all the time about how if a dragon is spewing fire, it has to have a way to protect itself. Did you think it was an interesting mechanism of having one head spewing the venom and the other head lighting things on fire?
No, because you still have to generate fire. It's not like it's creating a spark or anything. One of them's spewing fire and the other one is spewing an oil that enhances the fire.
Ah, that's what's happening. Okay.
Yeah, which made no sense. They're like, yeah, one head of the fuel. And it's like, no, the one is just spitting fucking fire out constantly. This other one just makes it worse.
Fucking chimera.
I did not see that. I thought
weird
it was,
ass chimera that shows up with a tail that's attacking people, and one of them has a horn, and yet he stabs one of the heads through, and it's still fucking going the entire time.
I liked it. I thought it was a fun monster. Well, I agree. Good Pokemon.
Great Pokemon.
Medusa. I was actually one of the monsters from the first film that I really liked. I thought that the woman who can turn you to stone by looking at you, who's also running around cackling in the distance and shooting arrows at you, felt like a...
Shooting really well, too. She's a hell of a shot.
I feel like we should already change this narrative and not call her a monster.
I was going to say, I think that we as Cinematic Animalia all agree that she's not a monster. She's definitely a very unfortunate victim of a horrendous circumstance on so many fronts.
Mm-hmm. But her most notable feature in both Greek mythology as well as the film is the ability to turn people to stone.
Hair snakes. Oh.
How are you going to say her boobs?
Jesus.
It's pretty notable on a fucking reptile, if that's what she is.
You can't turn anybody to stone unless you're the mafia and you're literally dumping them in a tank of cement at the end of the night, which would be a completely different storyline. Not one that I'm saying that I'm against for the Medusa, if you just see her like dragging them over at the end of it and wrapping them up in a carpet. Not something that's clearly happening here, though. So I do think they're just freezing. Now, freezing is actually a new area of research that they've been undergoing in the fight or flight response for the last couple of decades, because we've always said the two responses that exist from a scared animal are fight or flight. But anyone who's ever seen a bunny or a deer just absolutely freeze know that there is a third option. This freezing behavior seems to be most commonly seen within observed prey animals. They're caught in the freezing. Still, there's a lot of discussion as to why this feature would be useful. The idea is that it theoretically puts them in a state where maybe they won't be noticed if they've seen the predator. How effective that is still really argued. But we do see during these changes, there are a lot of physiological adaptations for this. They get alterations in their blood pressure, in their heart rate. And humans experience this with panic or anxiety attacks where we freeze. I don't think that's what's going on. I think this has more to do with the same behaviors that take place with snake bites, puffer fishes, or to a certain extent, fainting goats. Do you guys know what fainting goats are?
Yes.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
No.
You don't? Oh, boy.
Sam, you will definitely have to look this up either during while I'm talking or after, because it's terrifyingly hilarious. So during my time as a veterinarian, I did get to do goat work. And at one occasion, I did get to go out to a farm that had fainting goats that were present there.
Sorry, honey. I got to go off and do my goat work.
Goat work.
Myotonia congenita, present within goats, is an inherited disorder of the chloride channels in the muscles of their skeleton. So as a result, if these goats have sort of a sudden, unexpected reaction that takes place, this small change that's associated with the chloride channel leads to a reduced conductance of chloride ions. So it causes a delay in the relaxation of the muscles after the goat has made an involuntary movement. And if they keep trying to move, it will keep them paralyzed. And what this leads to is you'll have these goats that if you run at them suddenly, they literally freeze up and fall over. And they will continue to freeze up and fall over until you move away and they get to relax and then they get back up and they start moving again. It is a sick part of the human brain, mine included, that enjoys this phenomenon where you run and these poor goats go like, ugh! And they like freeze and they like flop over. And we all think this is fucking hilarious. And meanwhile, the goat is like, fuck you, man. I can't even run away.
That does sound quite mean. Sounds like a literal version of cow tipping.
Snakes, it's a common mechanism of a number of different snake species that they work on a slightly different basis. They can bite and trigger a snake bite paralysis, during which there is basically the poison binds to your nerves, or to specifically to the neuromuscular junction, and stops the transmission of a neurotransmitter that allows you to sort of contract or uncontract your nerves and can put you in a state where you become paralyzed. You can't move anymore. That's where
I've solved it.
That's where we get antivenoms, and we can give you various things that allow you to basically competitively bind, or in some cases to disengage the toxin. Now, the more interesting one, and I think the one that fits with what we're seeing here, is the tetrodotoxin. So tetrodotoxin is an extremely potent poison found mainly in the liver and sex organs of some fish, such as the puffer fish. It interferes with the transmissions of signals, nerves to muscles, and causes an increasing paralysis in the muscles. When the poisoning occurs, it can have an incredibly rapid onset. So basically, within 10 to 15 minutes of ingestion, humans can start to see the effects. You can have delayed effects 3 to 6 hours, rarely longer. When it interferes with the binding, basically by blocking sodium channels, there's a rapid weakening and paralysis of the muscles. Eventually, you lose the ability to breathe. It leads to respiratory arrest and eventually death. And these toxins, unfortunately, have been used by a number of different governments when we've isolated these compounds and used them as nerve agents, some of which can be aerosolized. A single drip inhaled into the lungs can cause the brain center to basically shut down control. You can lose control of your heart, your diaphragm, become paralyzed, and die very, very quickly.
Not a fun way to go.
No.
I think this is what our Medusa has. I don't think this is a direct eye contact, because in each of the scenes that it takes place, her face changes and there's almost like a beam or something spraying out from her. I think she's spraying out an aerosolized neurotoxin that she herself is likely immune to. It's hitting these soldiers. They're going into a tetanic convulsion. They're basically convulsing, freezing up, and becoming paralyzed, at which point they will die. And there's become this misrepresentation of they're turning to stone. And it actually fits with most of the characters that we see that get hit with this thing fall off the edge into the lava below. So it might be just Perseus turning around and being like, oh no, they've become frozen. And like, yeah, they're not stone. They are going to die whether or not they hit the lava or not. And fear makes people see crazy shit.
See, I think what might be happening is you have a combination of the tetrodotoxin and then the potent and the sheer speed of the venom that the cone snails have, where an animal dies before its brain could even register the pain of the injection of the needle itself. Mm. So you have Medusa making these faces at Ash's duty. Not jump on my computer right now. Sorry, the cat is attacking. I think you have an instance of Medusa making the face to distract her victim, or her would-be victim, and her big-ass tail with its stinger at the end comes around the back and just stings them real quick and then paralyzed immediately.
You don't think it's the face snakes? Just repeatedly biting them in the face while she distracts them? Shows.
It could be face snakes. Or, that could be a good
And maybe that's why she has boobs. They're staring at her boobs and she just gets them with the face snakes.
There you have it.
But it'd be a really good adaptation for hunting humans that are attracted to female bodies. I will say, though, regarding the fainting goats, I used to, I went on a few dates with a woman who had a similar condition with her. She had a nerve system disorder where if you scared her, she locked up like a goat and would just fall over.
I like how you're laughing already.
Oh my God. That's dangerous.
Like, it is dangerous. I never did it to her because that just seemed cruel, and it seemed something like, she had a good sense of humor about it, but I didn't want to push it. But the idea of a human doing what those fainting goats do makes me really happy.
I think that it just comes from Medusa getting men rock hard.
A line that was used throughout this film by my partner and I while watching this. Oh, Medusa got another one of them rock hard.
Yes. Nice one.
That,
nice.
And every time nice. That Io showed up, because in Greek mythology, Io is not a beautiful woman who's forced to walk the earth for a long period of time. She's a cow that gets turned into and then made immortal because both Zeus and Hera suck. But every time she showed up, I was like, God, Gemma Arterton just looking like a real heifer this movie. She's quite a cow.
I think my favorite bit about her is, for her first, like, 6 appearances, she was progressively less dressed. Like, she had a full-on, like, head cover and, like, her entire body cover. And then, like, the next time, the hood was down. Next time, her shoulders are showing. Next time, her complete, like, at a 45-degree angle from her right shoulder down across the left side of her chest was just completely exposed. And, like, her legs are more and more showed. Every single time, there was less and less clothing. I'm like, okay, I guess she's the love interest.
I think it's weird that she hooks up with a man who she's been watching since he was a child.
Yes.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, grooming.
And by weird, you mean hot, right?
Yeah, so hot. Fuck that nanny, Perseus. My God.
Because it took us months to find a good nanny, and I wouldn't want anything to, you know, drive her away.
So, what, you think I'm just gonna sleep with her, never call her again, and things are gonna get uncomfortable? Yeah, that sounds about right.
Dave, you had something about one-eyed monsters?
The last organism that I wanted to talk about today is the Cyclops. So the Cyclopses show up in Wrath of the Titan. They're great in Greek mythology, children of Poseidon. Here they apparently serve as the helpers of Hephaestus for the designing of the weapons. The Cyclopses are awkward. They're
the servants of who, Dave?
Hephaestus.
Hephaestus. Did you say
asbestos?
It's also
asbestos.
Anyways.
Asbestos.
So, also, is it actually Bill Nighy? I thought it was always Bill Nye.
Yeah, it's Bill Nighy.
It's Bill Nighy.
Okay, cool.
He's doing as best as he can.
What?
Adam, a rare pun from you.
Okay.
It's a slow clap from me.
Thank you.
They are Vulcan's helpers, if that makes you feel better.
Vulcan.
The Cyclopses are giant. They've got each of them has the defining one eye. The rest of them just look like hairy men, giant hairy men. One of them is clearly older with a cane. The idea of an organism having only one eye makes absolutely no sense from a terrestrial basis. On the planet, there is only one species that has one eye naturally occurring, and they're from the genus Copepods. They are these little real-world creatures. They're really small. Some of them are smaller than a grain of rice. I looked them up prior to the podcast, and they look like little lobstery things with one eye.
They're adorable. There's a ton of them in freshwater. Okay.
So they are found living underwater in oceans and lakes around the world. They've got tiny transparent bodies, long antennae, and just one eye. And the eye is called a median eye, located near the center of their head. It allows them to see differences between light and dark and gives them limited ability to navigate water.
I think there's a species of Daphnia that has one big eye, too. But maybe it has smaller ones, like accessory eyes.
It may be in the same group. You need two eyes. Two eyes give you depth perception, which might be why the Cyclops gets absolutely smashed in the head by that, his own trap. Which, side point, island no one else has been able to reach that can only be reachable by a god using a trident, and you cover the island in traps? Why? Anyways, the other problem with the eye, besides just having one, which means no depth perception for our Cyclops, is the shape of the eye. So we use our eye in terms of our standard pupil shape, which is what the Cyclops has, to allow us to get in lights and act in sort of a predatory fashion. Most other organisms that are in a more preyed upon position, example, goats, have a rectangular pupil that gives them that sort of wide panoramic view. I don't see any advantage in having our pupil size if they don't have two of them for what they're going to be encountering. And we didn't see any large predators or other organisms that they're running into on this island. I would imagine a very different pupil for what they're going to be doing, although I have no idea what these creatures eat.
My guess is a lot of congenital defects.
Yeah. Just severe inbreeding.
Yeah, we see three of them.
And they're all males.
That we know of.
We assume.
Yeah, you just didn't see boobs, and so you were like, they're all males. The eye is also way too small. Their center eye that's located, it's tiny. It's going to give them very limited range of motion for what they seem to be encountering and going through. So yeah, I agree. It's got to be a broken population with a passed on defect.
Yeah.
Dave's gone over some of the monsters. And look, Greek mythology was always full of fucking monsters. They pack a lot into these two films, but there's still a lot more out there. Like, we don't even get into the, you know, the kind of labors of Hercules and all the shit he had to put up with. Well, shit he inflicted on some fairly peaceful, minding their own business animals in some cases.
Or the literal shit he had to deal with the stables.
But if we had populations of these creatures just roaming around, how the fuck did humans manage to evolve and have, you know, reasonable societies in the same way? forgetting the whole, you know, conceit of the gods protecting them. Early humans, so Neanderthals, Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, had to put up with a lot of shit. Like, we talk about some of the old carnivores, like saber-toothed cats, dire wolves, cave bears. They existed at the same time as most species that came under the genus Homo. For instance, Homo therium, so not the saber-toothed cat, but a scimitar-toothed cat that was about 440 kilos in weight, which is about twice the size of a normal lion.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, they went extinct wherever Homo erectus showed up. Woolly rhinos, elasmotheriums, I mean, they're herbivores, so they're a hell of a lot more paranoid than carnivores are. They'll charge you just for stepping on a twig wrong. We had to put up with that sort of crap. Cave lions as well, which were larger than normal lions and which were very widespread throughout the whole of Europe. Cave bears.
Even worse.
Yeah, twice the size of European brown bears, although they believe that cave bears were 100% vegetarian, 100% herbivorous. So, you know, potentially not a threat a lot of the time unless they were attacked. But cave hyenas, not to mention the fact that, you know, the patron demon of the podcast, the hippo, is still running around Africa today.
Deadliest animal in Africa.
I mean, these were horrifying, massive species that were terrified of humans for the most part. And it's because once we got together, we started forming, you know, larger groups as early hominid culture progressed. Teamwork and the development of rudimentary technology was more than a match for most of these creatures.
Hippos can't make fake toes. Yeah,
working together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, when you lose your toe to the cave hyena and all you lose is your toe somehow, you can come back with your toe made of bitumen and kill its toe-eating ass.
And that's the thing. A lot of these larger carnivores, all they really need to do is, after they've gorged themselves, just do what early humans did, go and find them in a cave and fucking kill them while they're sleeping. I think that's what a lot of this shit would have been. I mean, we wiped out all of these species. And when I say we wiped out, I'm not talking about, you know, the way that we drive creatures to extinction today. I'm talking about, you know, humans as early species on the planet who needed to, you know, fight for survival, who are actually doing what they needed to do to get by.
Being more part of the food web and an actual competitor, integral predator or predator, and not this force of nature that we are today.
Yeah. So competition for shelter was a big thing. So that's why a lot of cave bears, cave hyenas got killed off, because they were competing for the same caves as Neanderthals. And the Neanderthals would do just that. They would just go and kill them while they were sleeping. Off a meal, that sort of thing. They would hunt them down. Woolly rhinos and mammoths, obviously, went extinct. They believe that that also has to do with a changing climate, but I don't think there's too much doubt that we at least played a part in their extinction as well. So I think even though you do have these horrifying species everywhere, the advent of cities, technology, and humans working together would have probably driven all these creatures to extinction eventually.
See, I think we have that going on, but also an interesting kind of reverse selection where they live in this hellscape of a land full of chimeras and hydras, literal, you know, multi-headed reptilian monsters that'll just kill your ass. And that would then just select for a really good human fighter population. And I think that you're in this world where fucking Mads Mikkelsen's character, Dracos, can jump off of a, you know, a ledge with his tiny little daggers, stab through a stalactite, drop that on top of poor Medusa's tail, and then be totally fine and ready to fight, all while he has an arrow through his chest. Like,
yeah.
Fighting these monsters is going to have to select for a population of humans that is very good at fighting these horrific monsters, and which would then eventually lead to this arms race type deal, potentially. And that's a very broad generalization of what the arms race evolutionary dynamics actually are, but it's interesting and fun for this podcast.
So it would select for drop kicks.
Yes, exactly.
The human population would be very pushed towards further drop. I'm totally for this.
But I mean, I think that this is a world where most of these species have been wiped out already. I mean, in most Greek mythology, these creatures don't rock up into towns. It's normally, you know, one person has to go out into the woods or out into the desert or, you know, find this isolated monster or creature or species that they have to murder. They've been driven away from human settlements already. These species know what's good for them. Then they're not going to evolve to be hanging around humans.
I feel like the one rare case being the Nemean lion terrorizing the countryside of Nemea, I guess, Hercules, for his labor, has to go take care of it. But that's the one I can think of where it's actually intruding upon human populations, and it's not just this poor creature minding its own business, and here comes the hero to kill it for no reason, Medusa.
One thing I will also point out here, because I think it'd be really interesting in this universe, I guess you'd call it, or in this world, is that the domestication of the wolf potentially helped humans out a lot in wiping out a lot of these other species. Domestication is, you know, it's always hard to say exactly when it happened. But, I mean, wolves all of a sudden went from a competitor for kills and for shelter to a potential ally for humans, which, you know, changes things completely. It not only means they're better at hunting, it means that they're better at guarding a kill, so that once they've brought something down, you don't have to worry so much about all these other species coming in and trying to take a kill.
Yeah, and that says nothing about the domestication of the giant scorpion.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I would be fascinated to see what sort of species were domesticated in this world.
So today for my section, I was going to do a little bit of a history lesson. So I assume everyone has heard of Homer. you know, we've studied him in school, either the Iliad or the Odyssey or both. Two epic poems that are often considered the foundational works of ancient Greek literature. But have you heard of Hesiod?
Of what?
No.
So Hesiod is also an author from the exact same time as Homer, around 700 BCE, who wrote two important epic poems as well, Theogony and Works and Days. So though not as long as Homer's, they were both still written in hexameter lines, which is ancient Greek poetry. Theogony is considered to be one of the first known Greek mythical cosmogonies. So sort of like the first recorded Greek universe family tree. Often used as the source book for the history of the Greek gods and goddesses and from whence they came. And I wanted to talk about this because it doesn't really touch on it too much in the first movie, but in the second movie, they hint at, you know, Zeus and Hades having a father. And I think most people are incredibly familiar with Zeus, but I feel like literature and media has fixated on Zeus so much as a character that has sort of wrongly portrayed him as the OG or father of deities. And so Zeus is actually, you guys may know some of this, but I sort of wanted to walk through the abridged version of Theogony. So this is where all the stories sort of come from. So Zeus is actually the great-grandson of the first primordial deity Gaia, or Earth. And here is the origins of the Greek god Zeus, according to Hesiod's Theogony. Yeah, ready for this story? So Gaia has a kid named Uranus. Naturally, once Uranus grows up, they sleep together and have 18 children.
As you do.
They have 18 children, and 12 of which were Titans, 3 Cyclops, and 3 Hecatoncheires.
You need to look up drawings of these, the other two.
So the Hecatoncheires or cherries, I don't know how to pronounce it, they're also called the Hundred Handers, which also needs to be a movie title. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
So now Uranus.
Whoa.
Uranus, he hid them, all their 18 children, he hid them all away inside of Gaia. Again, remember now here, she is Earth, so it's kind of like a weird interpretation of where he hides them. This pisses Gaia off, so she makes a special sickle and urges her children to punish their father. Only the youngest Titan, Cronos, was willing to step up. So Cronos hid behind the curtains, and when Uranus comes in to bang his mom for the 19th time, Cronos uses the sickle to castrate his father. Cronos now assumes supreme command of the cosmos and tries to ensure that it stays that way. Gaius and Uranus, not done fucking with people, tell Cronos that one of his own children he would overthrow his rule someday. So when Cronos finally marries a lovely woman named Rhea, who is also his sister, he made sure to swallow every single baby she birthed. So Hestia, Demeter, Hera, Hades, and Poseidon all went down with a little soy sauce. But upon witnessing her brother lover swallow 5 of her children, a pregnant Rhea begged her parents Gaia and Uranus to help save the 6, which is Zeus. So they took her abroad, where she secretly gave birth, and Gaia set about raising the boy in a cave. Rhea, in turn, gives Cronus a huge stone wrapped in baby clothes, which the father of the year immediately swallows without question. Zeus grows up, and through some Gaia mischief, manages to disgorge his 5 siblings from his father. Zeus then releases his trapped uncles, the Cyclopses, and the Hundred-Handers, who had still been trapped. They give Zeus a weapon hidden by Gaia, aka his thunderbolt, and thus the clash of the Titans begins. Zeus, his siblings, the Cyclops, and the Hundred-Handers versus Cronus and the other Titans. Zeus wins, overthrowing the Titans and trapping them in Tartarus. Zeus was claimed king of the gods and doled out honors and bestowed awards to those who helped him win. Zeus settles down and marries Metis, his first wife. And the dynamic duo mother-son-lover Gaia and Uranus, seemingly bored now, tell Zeus that Metis was fated to produce a son that also might usurp his rule. So naturally, like father-brother, like son-brother, Zeus swallows Metis while she is pregnant with Athena, thus ending the cycle of succession and securing his eternal rule over the cosmos.
So, like, are all these people just, like, dislocating their jaws to swallow these children? Are they just really big and these children are really small?
Well, Zeus swallows a pregnant woman.
Who?
That's what I'm saying.
Gives birth while inside him, trains her daughter, and then has her daughter come out via his head in full armor with a shield and a sword. And Libby didn't even get to the best part, which is what happens with Uranus's testicles. Which got...
This was the abridged version.
Which got whipped into the ocean, the blood from which formed the Furies, the Giants, and the Tree Nymphs. And then when the testicles hit the water, over a period of time, they eventually developed, formed into white sea foam, and hit the beach where they became Aphrodite.
I saw some person had made a Greek god family tree, and they did the lines, like, different colored lines to show, like, who was married, who was children. And then they literally had on the map key seafoam as one line. And then a special colored line for someone coming fully formed out of someone's forehead. That's what it said on the map key.
Perfect. See, this is what I mean. Like, at least this shit's entertaining and fun. Whereas in Christianity, it's just like, she was a virgin, but she somehow got pregnant. And the Greeks are just like, yeah, she was a virgin, but... She ate her father's brother's testicles and then threw herself into the sea, and then she just got pregnant, you know, naturally. That's how it works, right? Mm-hmm. There's creativity.
Exactly. And Poseidon was like, I think she's really hot. I'm going to turn her into a bull because bulls are cool. And I'm going to go, and she's going to be like, oh my God, this bull is so sexy and she'll definitely want to fuck me.
I worry about how many of these stories came about from awkward fathers being told that they had to talk to their children about sex. And they're just like, so a woman gets eaten and then she grows up and sprouts from the forehead. So don't fuck in my house.
Oh my God. Stranger danger. Teaching that to young kids would have been awful in like the Greek mythology times. Just like, okay, don't talk to any strange men or women, but also stay away from any rogue swans. Cows you should white probably bulls. Avoid religiously. White wolves, just any animals, really? Like, you can go out and, like, pet the chickens in the farmyard, but, like, anything watch outside out for these rain. Fences.
You know what? Just don't exist. It'll be safer.
And I also feel one of the best parts about Greek mythology is a lot of these stories were shared by wandering vagrants or beggars. And so in the stories, Greek gods will oftentimes pretend to be vagrants or beggars and come down and wander the towns. And I feel that's a wonderful way as a vagrant or beggar to protect yourself. And you're like, I could be Zeus. I could be fucking Zeus. Don't steal from me. Don't fuck with me. You don't know. You don't know shit.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, he's not a fucking god.
You don't know what I am. You don't know what I can do.
It's cool, Rick.
Doctor Who in this motherfucker. I could be a clone. I could be a hologram.
Okay, so I thought, because like some of us are really big fans of Greek mythology, in the sense of it's interesting, we're not fans of what they did, we just, you know, we enjoy the stories, and I thought, you know, we could go over our three most favorite representations of Greek mythology in modern media.
I think for me, these movies, Clash and Wrath of the Titans, would be my top number three.
Ooh.
It's a really cool representation of what these, this, the magic and the creatures and the gods walking amongst the humans and like what that would be like, even though we don't get to see too much of the gods, more just some monsters and like three of the gods. But it's a really cool representation, and it's one of those things, much like the Lord of the Rings, it's a world that I want to see more of, like, all the time, and see all these stories fleshed out and realized on the screen. Second, and it's kind of ironic because I've only played the Nordic side of this, but the God of War series is really fun, with kind of taking a character who I don't think is actually part of any Greek mythology, and just really throwing him into the whole, the pantheon of being like, fuck shit up, go kill everyone, just go crazy, go wild. Also now, go kill the Nordic gods too, because shit's wild. And then the top would be another video game, Hades. A really, really fun roguelike. So a game you have to, if you die, you go all the way back to the beginning and start all over. Mm-hmm. But it really takes that roguelike concept and it makes it work narratively, like why you keep starting over and why you can die but continue the story. And you interact with all the Greek gods, a lot of the characters from Greek mythology or from the wider pantheon. Like you meet primordial chaos, like the embodiment of that.
Mm-hmm.
The writing's really good. The acting is really good. It's a fun game to play, and I want to play more.
I love Hercules, the Disney movie. So good.
I forgot about that. God damn it.
My second, just, did you guys have Wishbone in the United States?
Oh, I loved Wishbone.
So Sam, Wishbone is a small terrier that he had a show that ran in North America for the longest time where he explores various like works of fiction, but he always plays the lead character. Wishbone did both a video game and a episode of The Odyssey in which you get to see him play as Odysseus. And if you want to see a small black and white dog wandering around delivering the lines of Odysseus, please treat yourself and check it out.
And he's got a great theme song. Okay. He's got a great theme song.
What's your story, Wishbone?
Did you read it in a book?
Okay.
Never watched it.
Have to take your word for this one.
Yeah. And then my absolute favorite that has just come out recently in the last couple of years. In 2018, Madeline Miller wrote a absolutely fantastic book called Circe. Which takes the perspective of Circe and takes a very female perspective of experiencing all of the Greek myths. It's incredibly accurate to a lot of the mythology. It does not shy away on how fucked up everything is. And it's a book I can confidently say it was actually given to my partner for a Christmas present. And then I took it from her and just sat down for like 2 days and just read all of it as she screamed at me to give her book back.
So I'll cut in here, Libby, because my number one is also Circe by Madeline Miller. And that's exactly what happened to me, too. My mum bought Circe for my wife, and I read it instead, and I fucking loved it. And I will also lump in Song of Achilles, which was her earlier book, with that as well. And it really doesn't shy away from how petty and squabbling and grotesque the gods are. Like, they go all in on how terrible everything is. And it's just fantastic. And my number two would be Hercules. Not the movie, but the video game that came out afterwards. My sister and I used to just... It's one of those stupid fucking side-scroller, really simple games. But me and my sister played that so much as kids. So that's probably a lot of nostalgia shining through. It's probably absolute shite, but I fucking loved it.
It's probably hard as fuck.
It was pretty hard, yeah. But we played on easy mode. I guess maybe there was an easy mode. I don't remember.
There weren't modes in those games. Those were just platformers like, guess what? You're going to keep going and it's going to get faster and harder and you're going to die and start over again.
Yeah. And if you die, you go all the way back to the start. Yeah. Yeah. And then, full disclosure, I have no movies on my list because I don't think there's been like any really good Greek mythology movies. But so my third is just going to be a recent comic book, which is Kill the Minotaur. Mm-hmm. Which was weird, but it's really interesting. So it takes the view of the Minotaur as like this alien species that was sent to, that landed on Earth. And the labyrinth is something that kind of grew around it. And it's a weird like sci-fi horror take on the story of the Minotaur. And it's really interesting.
Oh man, you saying the Minotaur, I want to jump back in real quick with Hades. One of the levels you have to go through is Elysium, which is where all the Greek heroes are. And the boss of Elysium is a combo of Perseus and the Minotaur. And Perseus is like this golden-haired, bronze-tan, like fake tan all over his body, like jock, who just talks like the most pompous hero ever. He goes, "Hey, foul demon, I will defeat you." You're like, "God damn it, I have to fight you again." He's like, "Yes, vile slime, I will kill you." It's like the most ridiculous theatrical nonsense, and it's so fun. And the Minotaur is just like, "Yeah, I fight with him now, so we're going to kill you."
Begrudging allies.
I tried to put some different ones on my list because I also do love the cartoon Hercules. I'm a big fan of God of War series as well for the video games. But for my list, actually harkens back to some childhood movies. Number three being Jason and the Argonauts.
Nice.
1963, Todd Armstrong as Jason. Nice. Yeah, I really liked it. My number two is actually...
Those skeletons were like a pioneer of stop motion, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Time? Yeah, those were terrifying to me as a kid.
I think they're the first use of computer-generated imagery in a movie. Oh,
really? Okay.
I could be wrong, but I think that's the fact what I know about those skeletons.
My number two is actually a song. It is the song from Regina Spektor called Oedipus. And I have always just really liked that version of the tale of Oedipus. For some reason, I just think she did a really good job with the... Stan keeps laughing and staring me up.
Have you guys ever heard of Tom Lehrer?
Yes.
Yeah, he has an amazing song about Oedipus Rex that I'll send to you afterwards. Okay. Sorry, Libby.
And then my number one all-time favorite representation of Greek mythology is the ever so near and dear to my heart, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, 1958. Fucking best Cyclops ever.
So ridiculous.
I love that movie. Also, I should, if I'm really bad at self-promotion, I have actually written, it's on Short Story Soup. Months ago, I wrote a short story where I did a little gender bending and have Hades as a female god, as well as some other fun role reversals.
It's really good.
It's called Cerby's Tale, Cerby.
Name is Hades, Lord of the Dead. Hi, how you doing?
Not now, okay?
Hey, I only need a few seconds, and I'm a fast talker, all right?
All right. Did we feel bad for any of the monsters? Well, I mean, obviously we all felt bad for Medusa.
Yeah, that she was labeled a monster.
Yeah, any of the monsters, though? Do we feel bad for any of them?
I feel bad for the scorpions.
I mean, one of them was just that dude's hand, and it becomes a scorpion all of a sudden.
Yeah.
One of them was just a drop of blood, then it became a scorpion. Then it got tied up by the djinn. You know, I feel like these are just animals doing their animal thing, like a lot of these monsters tend to be. And humans are like, I will be heroic and kill this poor, confused animal. Like that, the Chimera in Wrath of the Titans is obviously incredibly scared and stressed out in this human village that it finds itself in.
Just gets catapulted into the middle of a mess of people attacking it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, literally catapulted.
I think the only ones I didn't feel bad for were the creepiest ones, which is in the second movie, the demons that are like two people almost.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like fighting. Yeah. They were creepy.
Those are super
great
cool.
Scene in the movie of Liam Neeson and Ralph Fiennes, though, moving along and just like power slapping them into the ground.
God, there's some good actors in these films. It's just...
Right?
It's incredible. Would we recommend these movies? I love these movies, but no, actually, no. I don't love these movies anymore. I love the first one. I think the first one is just such stupid popcorn fun, but I would not recommend it to people.
I would recommend it with the caveat of like, look, this is not a good movie. It's a fun movie, and it's got monsters and Greek mythology. So, like, go put it on, have some fun, and then forget about it for 10 years like I did.
Yeah.
I have to say no. I don't even think they're that fun.
Libby's just been sitting there shaking her head for the entire podcast, just like regretting this decision. Yeah,
no. The class starts off good enough that I was hoping they'd stick with the whole angle of like rebel against the gods, but it's just such a mess.
I would have loved that. We need a film that goes all in on how shitty the gods were, the Greek gods. And we just
You write that movie, Sam. We'll get it made.
I'll write that movie.
Yeah, next week we're going to be moving away from Greek mythology and into, at least from my understanding of the book, more of a generic Amazonian folklore type curse. Amazonia? Yeah. And watching The Relic, 1997's own. And that'll be us next week. And as we say at the end of every podcast, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye. Bye.
We gods are losing our power. We believed Titans to be imprisoned forever. Now, they're breaking free.
It would mean chaos. The end of the world.
What am I meant to do?
Perseus, I need your help.
This is for gods, not humans.
You will learn someday that being half human makes you stronger than a god.